From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Today, as we enter African American History Month, we will hear a debate between the great writer James Baldwin and Malcolm X on civil disobedience and the sit-ins, this from 1961. And then, is the U.S. military seeking to turn the heavens into a new arena of war? We'll have a discussion. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The Washington Post is reporting that a political action committee established by Attorney General-designate John Ashcroft gave its fundraising list to Ashcroft's 2000 Senate campaign, a possible violation of campaign finance law by both the PAC and the campaign, this according to documents and election officials. The in-kind contribution to Ashcroft's campaign was a list of 100,000 donors that the PAC Spirit of America turned over to Ashcroft's 2000 Senate campaign committee. The campaign committee, in turn, made more than $116,000 by renting out the list to other fundraisers. Under federal law, PACs may give candidates only $10,000 per campaign. Neither the PAC nor the Ashcroft campaign reported the transfer of the list, which occurred after the campaign had already donated $100,000. Today, the Senate is poised to confirm John Ashcroft as President Bush's attorney general, ending a vitriolic cabinet struggle. Despite the near certainty of Ashcroft's confirmation, Democrats labored to muster enough nays to show Bush that Democrats could put up strong opposition to any potential Supreme Court nominee who, like Ashcroft, shared the president's views on abortion and states' rights. Frustrating the task were a half dozen Democrats who endorsed Ashcroft's nomination, including Connecticut Senator Christopher Dodd, who declared his intention in a less than glowing terms late yesterday. Dodd said, "I remain concerned that he will, as he appears to have done at times in the past, submit to the temptation to divide Americans along racial lines." Critics focused on Ashcroft's battles against abortion and against a school desegregation lawsuit while serving as Missouri governor and attorney general. They also cited Ashcroft's opposition to appointing James Hormel as the first openly gay U.S. ambassador, and they accused Ashcroft of using the nomination of Ronnie White to create a campaign issue. Democratic Senator Charles Schumer of New York said it's his past willingness to bend and torture the law. It's not simply what he said, but what he did when he had executive power. Black lawmakers aired a list of grievances to President Bush yesterday, reiterating their deep opposition to John Ashcroft as attorney general, reminding Bush of the wounds inflicted by the Florida election deadlock. 31 members of the Congressional Black Caucus discussed more than 20 issues with the Republican president, including racial profiling, election reform, AIDS, Africa, education, and civil rights. Bush pledged a high-level sensitivity on civil rights and promised to make Africa a high priority. Three Black Caucus members from Florida did not attend the White House meeting because they felt it was inappropriate given the disputed election there. Those who attended informed Bush of the absences. The caucus, whose members are all Democrats, walked out on January 6th as Congress certified George W. Bush's victory when the electoral votes were counted. Nearly 2 years after the fatal shooting, the Justice Department has decided not to pursue federal civil rights charges against the four New York City police officers who gunned down Amadou Diallo, an unarmed West African immigrant in New York. The U.S. Justice Department yesterday decided not to pursue federal civil rights charges against the officers who killed Amadou Diallo in a hail of 41 bullets outside his Bronx apartment on February 4, 1999. The four officers, Kenneth Boss, Sean Carroll, Edward McMillan, and Richard Murphy, were acquitted of murder and other charges in a state criminal trial last year. The officers all testified Diallo's fatal shooting was a tragic mistake, claiming they thought he was reaching for a gun in a dimly lit vestibule of his building. Diallo, it was revealed, was actually reaching for his wallet. Kadiatou Diallo, Amadou's mother, said, "I cannot convey to you the sadness I feel by hearing this decision." She added she has found justice very elusive since she came to the United States shortly after her son's death. Amadou Diallo's father, Saiku, is still convinced that the officers have not been punished for his son's death. Shortly after Giallo's death, U.S. Attorney Mary Jo White announced her office had begun the civil rights probe. White's office also has a separate, broader investigation underway into police training and practices, especially by the Streets Crimes Unit in New York. Again, the Justice Department has decided not to pursue federal civil rights charges against the officers who killed Amadou Diallo. His family still has a civil rights lawsuit pending. Libya said today it may consider paying compensation to the Lockerbie victims, but it will never accept responsibility for the bombing. Amid conflicting signals from the Tripoli government, Washington and London united in insisting that Libya must pay up and accept the blame. Libyan state-run television said yesterday a Libyan convicted of murdering 270 people in the 1988 Lockerbie airliner bombing would lodge an appeal. It said defense lawyers would appeal within 2 weeks against the court's verdict on Abdelbaset el-Megrahi. Another Libyan was found not guilty by the special Scottish court sitting in the Netherlands. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, and on this first day of African American History Month, we bring you a debate between two greats of the 20th century, Malcolm X and James Baldwin. It was 40 years ago. John F. Kennedy was president, and the civil rights movement in America was fighting for racial and economic justice. On April 25th, 1961, two giants of African-American history faced each other in a debate on the nature of racism in America and specifically looked at the sit-ins and their effectiveness and talked about possible solutions. James Baldwin was sitting across from Malcolm X. This is a rare recording of their debate. James Baldwin, the great author and activist, he wrote Giovanni's Room, Go Tell It on the Mountain, The Fire, Next Time, and many other books. Malcolm X was assassinated 4 years later, leader of the one of the leaders of the Nation of Islam, as they sat in debate, talking about the issues that plagued America. This
first, I would like to say that I'm speaking not for myself, but as a follower and helper and representative of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, who is the spiritual head of the fastest growing group, religious group, of black people here in the Western Hemisphere.
And this is Malcolm X.
When we give our views, we don't give them as a civic group, we don't give them as a political group, but we give them primarily as a religious group. And any solution that we set forth, we absolutely feel that it's a religious solution rather than a political solution. One of the reasons that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, in teaching us here in America, has giving us a solution that differs drastically from the sit-in movement. He's trying to make us men. Now, the very fact that you find students all over the world today are standing up for their rights and fighting for their rights. But here in America, the so-called Negro students have allowed themselves to be maneuvered under a tag of sit-in. Actually, I guess it describes it, the name describes its nature. It's a passive thing. And if their goal is integration, it's not a worthwhile one. But if their goal is freedom, justice, and equality, then that's a worthwhile goal. If integration is going to give the black people in America complete freedom, complete justice, and complete equality, then it's a worthwhile goal. The holding this integration bottle, dangling it in front of the Negroes in America today, has actually disabled them, or it has nullified their ability to stand up and fight like a man for something that is theirs by right, rather than to just sit around and beg and wait for the white man to make up his mind that they're worthy to have this type thing. I think that this is, in my opinion, why we disagree with the sit-in movement. If they are willing to wait for another 100 years for the white man to change his mind to accept them as a human being, then they're wrong. But if they're willing to lay down their life tonight or in the morning in order that we can have what is ours by right tonight or in the morning, then it's a good movement. But as long as they're willing to wait for the white man to make up his mind that they are qualified to be respected as human beings, then I'm afraid that all of their waiting and their planning is for naught. As Thurgood Marshall said on New Year's Eve, the Supreme Court brought about the desegregation decision, I think, 6 or 7 years ago, and there is only 6% desegregation in America right now. We don't call two students, black students, going to University of Georgia integration, nor do we call four children, black children, going to school in New Orleans integration, nor do we call a handful of black students going to school in Little Rock integration. If every black man in the state of Arkansas can't go to any school he wants, that's not integration. And if every black child in the state of Louisiana cannot go to any school that they are qualified for in the morning, then that's not integration. And likewise with Georgia and any other state in America. It's no integration with us until the entire thing is given, is laid on the table, not 100 years from now, but in the morning. And at the rate that the NAACP, CORE, and the Urban League is willing to accept the change of attitude in the white man's mind, we who are Muslims feel we'll be sitting around here in America for another 1,000 years, not waiting for civil rights or something like that, but even waiting to be granted the rights of a human being.
I have the feeling that a great many words have been floating around this table, which need to be redefined. And that, by the way, is the problem I think which facing this entire country. Now, I don't agree with Mr. X about the sit-in movement, and I do know something about the war, the incipient war between the students and some of the leaders. I know the gap, the enormous gap between the NAACP and the children in the South. I don't agree that the sit-in, you know, I don't agree that it is necessarily passive. I think it demands a tremendous amount of power, both in one's personal life and in terms of political or polemical activity, sometimes to sit down and do nothing or seem to do nothing. But finally, when the sit-in movement started, or when a great many things started in the Western world, it was not, I think it had a great deal less to do with equality than it had to do with power. And I do think we have to decide what we want, you know. Now, what has happened in the world in relation to black people? It's not that white people have suddenly changed or become more conscious of a black man's humanity. It is, what has happened is very simple. It is the white power has been broken. And this means, among other things, that it is no longer possible for an Englishman to describe an African and make the African believe it. It is no longer possible for a white man in this country to tell a Negro who he is and make the Negro believe this. The controlling image is absolutely gone. Now, it seems to me the responsibility which faces us then, the question which faces me in any case, is since there is a distinction between power and equality, there is a distinction between power and freedom, and I know that in terms, for example, of Africa, that an African nation cannot expect to be respected unless it is free. I know that unless it has its political destiny in its own hands, which is what we mean by power, there is no hope that the English will deal with an African nation on. They will deal with an African nation as a subjugated nation as long as it is in fact subjugated. Now, this is not quite the same situation that we face here in America as American Negroes. I can see that I might very well, for one reason or another, leave this country tomorrow and never come back. But this will not make me, I will not cease to be an American Negro for this reason. And the history of our history in this country is something that I think we have to face, especially since we're demanding that white people face it. And whether I like it or not, whether you like it or not, this issue about integration is a false issue because we have been integrated here ever since we got here. I am no longer a pure African. There are no pure Africans in this country. The history which has produced us is something which, in any case, we're going to have to deal with one of these days. Now, I think it is a mistake to pretend this history did not happen. What we're arguing about, I think, one of the things, in any case, I think I would be arguing about, is the effect of this on the Negro world and the great divisions in it, so that it does, in fact, range from people who imagine they are white, you know, who never talk to Negroes, to people who imagine that if they can make a buck, they will somehow beat the system, to homeless and demoralized black boys and girls who have who don't know where to go. The issue, it seems to me, the reason that the student movement is important, the reason this whole ferment is of such importance, is not that I want anybody's cup of coffee, or even to go, particularly to anybody's school. It is because the country cannot afford to have, as it has at this moment, millions of black boys and girls in various ghettos all over the country, either perishing literally or perishing, I must say, finally, with the kind of demoralization and bitterness and hatred which can, after all, blow this country wide apart. The importance, in my mind, of the Muslim movement, in conclusion, is that it is the first time, I think, in the history of this country that a Negro audience, a Negro laborer, a Negro schoolboy has heard his own condition described without anybody trying to flinch from it. It is very different from hearing a speech by Roy Wilkins in which, you know, one is told in one way or another that tomorrow will be better. And I think this has a tremendous effect. This is the reason the Muslim speaker has so much power over his audience. It comes out of a failure in the Republic. This country has lied about the Negro situation for 100 years. And now what has happened is that the lies are no longer viable, can no longer be accepted even when they can be told. And the country has waited so long that it does not know how to handle this and has created a moral vacuum. There's a moral vacuum in the Negro ghettos in the same way there's a moral vacuum in New Orleans, which is filled with desperate people. Now, I don't think that we can afford this. It seems to me, and now I speak for myself, my quarrel with the official Negro leadership, and my quarrel with those such Negroes as imagine they are integrated or imagine they somehow escaped the Negro condition, is that they are not willing to do what I think is absolutely essential. One has got to re-examine the basis, the standards of this country, which not only afflict black people, they afflict the entire country. No one in this country, as far as I can see, really knows any longer what it means to be an American. He does not know what he means by freedom. He does not know what he means by equality. We live in the most abysmal ignorance of not only the condition of 20 million Negroes in our midst, but of the whole nature of the life being lived in the rest of the world. And I think that the American white man, the Republic, is beginning to pay for his treatment of the Negro in terms of what he does not know about the rest of the world. You cannot live, it seems to me, you cannot live 30 years, let's say, with something in your closet which you know is there and pretend it is not there without something terrible happening to you. By and by, what I cannot say, if I know that any one of you, you know, has murdered your brother, your mother, and the corpse is in this room and under the table, and I know it, and you know it, and you know I know it, and we cannot talk about it, it takes no time at all before we cannot talk about anything, before absolute silence descends, And that kind of silence is descended on this country. I think that this country has become almost inconceivably radical overnight. It has really got to do something it has not done before, and this involves the humanity of everybody in it. And the key to this is in the Negro. If one can face that, one can face anything. But that has not been faced. And I think this is the reason for the confusion and the ferment and the great, great danger. Again, let me say this, and I will stop. I'm not religious. And therefore, since I'm not religious, all theologies, for me, are suspect. All theologies have a certain use. But I never, for example, believed in the myth of the virgin birth, and I never quite understood why it was necessary to propagate such a peculiar notion. Therefore, you know, as theologies go, it seems to me the Muslim theology is just as good as any. One cannot quarrel with it there. I can't, anyway. But I personally reject that theology as I reject all others. And I don't think that we need it. Now, this is a gamble. This is a very reckless thing to say. And perhaps, you know, perhaps it's very mystical. I know the kind of world I would like to see. I would like to think of myself as not needing to be supported by a myth. I would like to think of myself as being able to face whatever it is I have to face as me, dealing with what I have and what there is, without having my identity dependent on something which finally has to be believed, which cannot be tested. This is why one is converted to a religion, you know. I think that there's something very dangerous in it. What I would like to see, and maybe we will never live to see it, is a world in which these things are not necessary, which I will not need to invent, in effect, a heritage and a history, but I can deal with the one I have, and will not need, in order to deal with the rest of the world, will not need to feel superior to them, but simply be a part of them. And it seems to me this may happen. Well, I'd love to see a world in which there are no blacks, there are no whites, where it does not matter. Because as long as it does matter, and it doesn't matter who is wearing the shoe, the confusion will be great and the bloodshed will be great.
Well, I, as a black man, and proud of being a black man, I can't conceive of myself as having any desire whatsoever to lose my identity. I wouldn't want to live in a world where none of my kind existed.
That is Malcolm X and James Baldwin in debate. We're going to come back to that debate here in a minute on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, The Exception to the Rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue on this first day of African American History Month with an historic discussion, debate, between two giants of U.S. history, Malcolm X and James Baldwin, as they discuss on April 25th, 1961, nonviolent civil disobedience and sit-ins, their effectiveness. We're just listening to James Baldwin. This is Malcolm X.
As a black man, and proud of being a black man, I can't conceive of myself as having any desire whatsoever to lose my identity. I wouldn't want to live in a world where none of my kind existed. I do think that the Negro, American so-called Negro, is the only person on earth who would be willing to lose his identity in a what you might call a new product. I heard one fellow say one day that there eventually intermarriage and intermixing would take place on such a vast scale that it would produce a chocolate-colored race. And Martin Luther King was in a discussion, televised discussion, with a white newspaper man. I saw it on the television a couple months ago. And this white newspaper man put this to him. He said, he pointed out that he's proud of his white race. He's proud of what he is. He's proud of his racial characteristics to the extent where he has no desire to lose it by mixing with any other race. And the thing that he said he couldn't understand was why the so-called Negroes don't have the same racial pride that whites have in trying to retain their characteristics. And Martin Luther King never answered him, although he should have answered him. I think that it is disastrous for the black people in America to reach the point where their racial pride disappears, and they don't care whether their blood is mixed up with someone else's. I think that also one of the things that brings this about, as the Honorable Elijah Muhammad teaches us, the very fact that you have to refer to the black man in America as a Negro shows you that right there something is wrong. An African doesn't accept this term Negro. And you find they teach us in the educational system of this country that Negro is a Spanish word that's supposed to mean black. Yet when you find the black people who live in Spanish-speaking countries of South and Central America, they don't accept the word Negro to identify themselves. No one allows himself to be classified under the word Negro but the black man here in America who is a descendant of the slaves. And very seldom is it ever applied to anybody but the black man in here in America who is the descendant of the slaves. When you ask a man his identity, he should use a word that connects him with a culture. If you ask him his nationality, it should connect him with a nation. Like if I ask a man his nationality and he says German, that connects him with Germany. Or if he says, even if he says German-American, it still connects him with having originated. His family, his history has originated in Germany. If he says he's French-American, it connects him with France. But when you ask the black man in America and he tells you Negro, he doesn't put any other country in front. He puts American Negro, or he'll just say Negro. This doesn't identify him. And usually when you find a man who calls himself a Negro, he can't tell you what language that he spoke before he came to this country. It's of no consequence, no interest. He believes that prior to coming here, he was a savage in the jungle, and therefore he had no language. And this justifies his lack of knowledge concerning that mother tongue today. And the history, as Mr. Baldwin pointed out, of the white man here in America and the black man here in America points up the fact that the Negro, or the man here who calls himself a Negro, is just an ex-slave. If he is an ex-slave, I'd rather say he's still a slave. But he's wearing his slave master's name, the name that was given to him during slavery. He's speaking the language of the man who made him a slave because he has no knowledge of his own tongue. He only knows the history, his own history, as taught to him by his former slave master, who purposely hid from him his own history to make him think that he was an inferior being before being brought here. And Mr. Muhammad teaches us that until the black man here in America is connected or reestablished or given some knowledge of his existence prior to coming here to America, his own appraisal of himself will be so low that he'll actually think that the white man is doing him a favor to let him be here in America, no matter what his status is. And he also, and this is one of the reasons today why he fights so hard, some of them, to sit down next to the white man. They actually think that the white man is the personification of perfection, and whenever they're allowed to go live in his neighborhood or sit in his restaurant or mingle or socialize with him, that they have attained, that they have made progress. But when they go back and study the history of their own people, and the accomplishments of their own people, the civilizations and cultures, black civilizations and black cultures that existed in Africa at a time when the whites in Europe were living a cave-like existence, then immediately their appraisal of their self, of themselves begins to go higher. And they don't think that to beg somebody to mingle with them in this country is any kind of progress whatsoever. And I would like to say one more thing, too, on that nonviolent thing, that the black man in America is the only one who is encouraged to be nonviolent, or the black man in Africa, or the black man in Asia. Never do you find white people encouraging other whites to be nonviolent. Whites idolize fighters. They idolize the Hungarian freedom fighters who came to this country and right now can work on jobs that the sit-in students can't get, can live in neighborhoods that the sit-in students can't live in, and can go into public places that the student sit-ins can't go, because they are fighters. Everyone loves a fighter. They respect a fighter. And but at the same time that they admire these fighters, they encourage the so-called Negro in America to get his desires fulfilled with a sit-in stroke or a passive approach or a love-your-enemy approach or pray for those who despitefully use you. This is insane. And we feel as Muslims, until we see white people practicing this nonviolence, take Pearl Harbor. When the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, the American white man didn't say, pray for the Japanese and let them now bomb Manhattan or Staten Island. No, they said, praise the Lord, but pass the ammunition. But and if anybody comes along like Mr. Muhammad and begins to point out uncompromisingly in blunt terms that don't need diplomatic language that can be misinterpreted, and he begins to point out these atrocities and crimes that have been committed against black people here in America today, the white man can never deny the fact that he's guilty, but he'll always say, well, forget the past and let's look forward. But the only people who are told to forget the injustices that have been done to them are the black people. But when it comes to whites, right today, you can turn on any radio, turn on any television, read any newspaper, and the Jews have magnified to the world the crimes that were committed against them 20 years ago or so by Eichmann, and they keep you sitting on the edge of your seat wanting to strangle Eichmann and strangle the Germans. This is it's almost like a Hate Germany campaign, but yet the Jews are never accused of teaching hate because they remind the world of the crimes that were committed against them. But when the black man here in America begins to stand up and speak about the crimes that are committed against him throughout America every day, no let up, just different forms, immediately a black man who dwells on that is considered a racist, considered an extremist, or considered someone who is advocating a doctrine that'll bring about violence and bring about a deterioration in the so-called good relations that are supposed to be developing between black and white in this country. So we just can't go along with any of that. And I think that this is the thing that the white people of America should realize, that Mr. Muhammad's teaching, and it's spreading, so you have to deal with it. Mr. Muhammad's teaching doesn't teach the black man to wait for the white man to change his mind. Mr. Muhammad's teaching is changing the black man's appraisal of himself and changing the black, and as soon as the black man undergoes a reappraisal of himself and realizes that he's a man too, he says to himself, why should he wait for the Supreme Court to give him what a white man has when he's born? Why should he wait for the Congress or the Senate or the President to tell him that he should have this, when if he's a man the same as that man is a man, he doesn't need any President, he doesn't need any Congress, he doesn't need any Supreme Court, he doesn't need anybody but himself to bring about that which is his, if he is a man?
I think in the first place there's some disagreement between Mr. Malcolm X and myself as to what this heritage is. And I want to go back to that in a minute. Something else at the moment bothers me. I think there's not much clarity in this question of violence. From my point of view, from where I sit, whether or not, no matter what Mr. X wants, no matter what I want, I believe, for example, that one of these days, maybe tomorrow, Birmingham, Alabama will probably blow up. And if Birmingham blows up, it will not just stretch to Atlanta, it will stretch to Boston. There's a kind of fuse. There's a kind of there's an undercurrent. There's something which unites all the Negroes in this country, so that what happens in Birmingham can blow up Harlem. It has happened before. And unless we are extremely swift and miraculously swift, it will happen again. I take violence as given. I think it is coming in any case. What exercises my mind is what happens then. In the first place, this country, in its position in the world now, is extremely precarious position in the world now. The situation of the Negro here is different from that of the Jews in Germany, let us say, 20 or 30 years ago. In that, if Birmingham should blow up, if they should really erupt in America this week, real racial violence, it would have repercussions all over the world. I'm afraid we have to face this fact, that when the Jews were being slaughtered in Germany in the very beginning, no one seemed to care. Millions of Jews crossed the world, and boatloads of them, and no country would let them in. But the American Negro has something working for him in this context, or the country has something working against it, which I don't think he can afford. But I want to get back to this question of identity, because it seems to me this is where all the questions are. Mr. Malcolm X disagrees with the word Negro, and I can see his point. I confess that it doesn't at the moment much interest me, but that may be my fault. What I am concerned about, though, is the actual history of Negroes in this country. I think one has got to face the fact that it has been one of the ugliest histories in the history of the West. But if one can face this fact, there's another fact which I think one has got to face, which is that it's also one of the most remarkable histories that we know of. And I'm not talking now about all the good things that white people did, for the poor darkies and all that jazz. I'm talking about the effect of this experience on the people who underwent it, the masters and the slaves, what it did to them. I would be a very different person if I were not the descendant of a slave. In fact, I am the descendant of a slave, and this is one of the things I have to deal with because it is true. And I don't think that it has to be a badge of shame. Negroes are not the only slaves. We are not the only descendants of slaves. I can't eliminate one half of my ancestors. My grandmother was raped, let us say. This is a fact I have to face. This means that I'm no longer a pure African, and that my relationship to white people is not that of a Congolese to Belgium, and cannot be, no matter how hard I try to make it that. My relationship to white people is dictated by my mother's relationship to them, my father's, by the fact that my grandmother nursed children who grew up to lynch her children, that my father's fathers were always under the heel of some benevolent white man, and the whole myth of this experience has come into being in the country, which is at its highest seen in Faulkner and at its lowest seen in Margaret Mitchell. Now, I don't think that we can be liberated from this history until we are willing to deal with it. And this means that I have to deal with it as well as any white man in the country has to deal with it. There's really too much and too little to say. What is the issue here? Malcolm X wants us to act like men, and it seems to me, one of the things that I object to here, I don't think that the fact that white people have done what they have done, Patrick Henry is not one of my heroes. I'm sorry, most American heroes have never been in my Hall of Fame. I don't see any reason for me, at this late date, to begin modeling myself on an image which I've always found, frankly, to be mediocre and not a standard to which I myself could repair. I don't think that black men now should be, because white men have committed these crimes, that black men should do the same thing. I think that there is something absolutely insidious. Even if I cannot make this absolutely clear, there's something, to my mind, always terribly insidious in the whole question of race. The white man's racial characteristics, of which the white man claims to be so proud, have reduced him in this country to incredible levels. There is nobody in the world, I think, sadder than a white man in the deep South who only has his skin and his blue eyes and his yellow hair and nothing else. I don't think that I want to go through the world, and I will not encourage my nephew to begin to go through the world only armed with the color of his skin. The only thing that really arms anybody when the chips are down is how closely, how thoroughly he can relate to himself and deal with the world, yes, as a man, But I don't think, I think when I talk about standards, I say they all got to be revised. This is one of the standards that has to be revised. I don't think that a warrior is necessarily a man. And in fact, it has been proven that football players and all these people in teams and in armies are not men. It is very difficult to be a man. And what it involves for me, anyway, is an ability to look at the world, to look at whatever it is, and to say what it is and to deal with it, to face it, even if it does mean laying down your life, because in a way it always does mean that.
James Baldwin and Malcolm X in debate, April 25th, 1961. On this first day of African American History Month, you're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. When President George W. Bush chose Donald Rumsfeld as his Secretary of Defense, he gave a clear signal that the United States would push forward with plans for a national missile defense system. Rumsfeld headed a congressional commission charged with assessing the ballistic missile threat facing the United States. His report warned that a, quote, rogue state such as North Korea or Iran could obtain a ballistic missile capable of reaching the U.S. within 5 years. But in the report of the United States Space Command titled Vision for 2020. Missile defense is located as only one step in the Space Command's plans to control and dominate space in the next 20 years. Today, we'll take a look not only at the U.S. plans for a national missile defense system, but also at the U.S. Space Command and its plans for the militarization of space. We begin with Major Barry Venable, the public affairs officer at the United States Space Command. The report, Vision for 2020, begins with the following. It says, historically, military forces have evolved to protect national interests and investments, both military and economic. During the rise of sea commerce, nations built navies to protect and enhance their commercial interests. During the westward expansion of the continental United States, military outposts and the cavalry emerged to protect our wagon train settlements and railroads. The emergence of space power follows both of these models. Over the past several decades, space power has primarily supported land, sea, and air operations strategically and operationally. During the early portion of the 21st century, space power will also evolve into a separate and equal medium of warfare. Likewise, space forces will emerge to protect military and commercial national interests and investment in the space medium due to their increasing importance. What is meant by space power will also evolve into a separate and equal medium of warfare? Major Barry Venable.
Well, I think we need to start off with the understanding that as far as the U.S. military is concerned, space is a center of gravity or a key cornerstone of our ability to perform our missions. I would also submit that space is a center of gravity for the United States as a whole. We use space every day in ways that other countries are only beginning to adopt. Take, for example, every time you use a credit card, that transaction at some point moves through space.
What are the plans for development of space weapons?
Well, currently, and this is key to understand, the notion of weapons in space is not consistent with U.S. national policy. Planning for the possibility that someday they may be is the purpose of the U.S. Space Command long-range plan. Important to understand that should our civilian leadership at some point decide that application of force from space is in our national interest, we feel that it is our responsibility responsibility to have at least planned for that eventuality or possibility.
When money is in the budget for, say, NASA, that is separate from the Pentagon. And yet, would you say that these two areas are merging now and that there are perhaps, when there's budget for NASA, these are hidden costs for the Pentagon?
No, I would not say that. I'm not qualified to comment on the NASA budget. Civil space operations are separate and distinct from military operations. From a budgetary responsibility standpoint, it's important to understand, though, that due to the extremely high cost associated with space systems, that the civil, commercial, and military sectors are rapidly seeking to capitalize on each other's capabilities. In the military, for example, we make extensive use of imaging satellites, commercial imaging satellites, and the products derived from them, rather than undertaking the launching our own programs.
Let me ask you something. In the vision for 2020, it says under future trends, although unlikely to be challenged by a global peer competitor, the United States will continue to be challenged regionally. The globalization of the world economy will also continue with a widening between haves and have-nots. What does that mean? Why is the U.S. Space Command concerned about this?
Well, we're concerned that from a space standpoint, when we say haves and have-nots, there are going to be those who have space-based assets and those who do not. Those who do not, however, can very easily, through asymmetric means, attempt to deny us use of our space assets.
The United States has been part of the Outer Space Treaty, an international treaty initiated by the U.S. to keep weapons out of space for 34 years. What's your position on that treaty?
Well, the Outer Space Treaty, adopted in 1967, among other items, essentially promotes the idea that space should be used for peaceful purposes. It specifically refers to the moon and other celestial bodies. One of the key provisions of the Outer Space Treaty is that nuclear weapons and other weapons of mass destruction cannot be placed into orbit or stationed in space in any manner. And quite simply, that is the key element of that treaty as it relates to our topic today. The important thing to understand that I think is in fact national policy is that unless something's specifically prohibited, it's permitted. And the Outer Space Treaty quite simply bans weapons of mass destruction in space, but it doesn't ban weapons in space.
And so the weapons that are acceptable?
Well, weapons are only acceptable provided that our national civilian leadership decides so.
In November of 2000, the UN, concerned about U.S. plans for a national defense system, voted to reaffirm the Outer Space Treaty. The U.S. and Israel were the only two countries to abstain. Why did the U.S. abstain?
No, I can't speak for the government of the United States in that regard.
Finally, the U.S. Space Command's long-range plan thanks 75 corporations for their contributions, like Lockheed Martin, Boeing. How are corporations involved with the U.S. Space Command's plans overall? Is it appropriate that corporations, which are profit-seeking by nature, should be involved?
Well, I think the question as it relates to the space industry can be applied to any other industry which supports any facet of the military, whether that is producing food or producing rocket boosters. We rely very heavily on the private space sector for launch capability and leverage some of their capabilities in space. The expertise found there in what is really a very narrow career field, a very specialized career field, whether it be in the commercial, civil, or military sector, is very valuable, and so we seek those their input, solicit their assistance in what is a very challenging endeavor whenever one attempts to operate in space.
Well, Major Barry Venable, I want to thank you for being with us, Public Affairs Officer at the U.S. Space Command.
Yeah, you're very welcome. Thank you.
And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we continue on our conversation with weapons in space, I'm sorry that Major Venable would not go on with people, with critics of national missile defense and weapons in space. But we are joined on the phone by Carl Grossman, investigative reporter at the College of Old Westbury and author of the forthcoming book, Weapons in Space. He also did the TV documentary Star Wars Returns. Your response to some of what Major Barry Venable had to say about the use of weapons in space and whether the development of weapons violates the Outer Space Treaty, which the United States is a signatory on. Carl Grossman.
Well, the intent of the U.S. military, particularly the U.S. Space Command, is it's declared in numerous documents. For example, I have one in front of me here called the United States Space Command Vision for 2020. And it opens up declaring U.S. Space Command dominating the space dimension of military operations to protect U.S. interests and investment. Goes on to describe the model during the rise of sea commerce. Nations built navies to protect and enhance their commercial interest during the westward expansion of the continental United States. Military outposts and the cavalry emerged to protect our wagon train settlements and railroads. Goes on about the globalization of the world economy continuing with a widening gap between the haves and the have-nots. Put it all together, clearly what the U.S. Space Command thinks its role is. It's kind of like the great fleets of the empires of Europe or the cavalry. We would attempt to, from space, the ultimate high ground of space, that's the way space is described in military documents, control the planet below. As to the Outer Space Treaty, it was in fact initiated by the United States in the early 60s to keep war out of space. I've spoken indeed for the new TV documentary Star Wars Returns. He appears, Craig Eisenstroth, explaining that our focus, he was in the State Department at the time, our focus was to keep weapons out of space, period. Eisenstroth said, well, in the end, it came to say, there's a prohibition against nuclear weapons of weapons of mass destruction. He believes that the laser weapons that the U.S. Space Command, U.S. military, wants to put up in space are also a violation of the Outer Space Treaty, and it's certainly the intent of the Outer Space Treaty. And then finally, Canada, just to clear up any confusion, has been moving at the United Nations to strengthen the Outer Space Treaty and have it say, no weapons in space, period. But the U.S. has been challenging, has been fighting that.
I wanted to bring Deborah McKenzie into this discussion, a European reporter for New Scientist magazine. She's in Brussels right now. What effect does the development of national missile defense and space weapons have on Europe, where you are, and China? Will it have the stabilizing effect the U.S. predicts?
No, it will have a very destabilizing effect. Every single ally of the United States is opposed to this, just about. The Europeans are terribly opposed to it, I think possibly because they're used to living in a world where you rub up against other countries a bit more often than possibly most Americans do. For one thing, they're very much aware of what national missile defense in the United States is going to do to China. China's basically going to literally go ballistic.
What do you mean?
Well, right now, China has a fleet of sort of basic but usable ballistic missiles, nuclear-tipped, single nuclear warhead per missile. Those typically, if Star Wars ever works, are what it's going to be easiest to shoot down. Nuclear missiles that have more than one warhead on them are considered to be more likely to get around such a system, but single weapons or missiles are considered to be sitting ducks if indeed NMD ever works. So China's going to feel in a position where the United States could, if it chose, bomb it, and it can't bomb back. And it's not going to like that, and it's not going to allow that situation to persist. So what it will do, first of all, is it's going to develop a new generation of nuclear warheads, missiles with more than one warhead on them. That means it's going to have to test. That means it's never going to ratify the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. And that's just for starters. Right now, China's blocking progress on a treaty that could end the nuclear arms race. It's been on the agenda in Geneva for a couple of years, but it's gone nowhere. It's called the Fissile Material Cutoff Treaty, and it's a treaty that will effectively ban its participants from producing highly enriched uranium or plutonium, or at least any more of it, for use in nuclear weapons. It will basically, at one fell stroke, you know, end the arms race because you won't be able to produce any more fuel. Well, that would be great, but China has prevented any discussion of it, subject to the Americans stopping any support for national missile defense.
Have European nations muted their criticism at all since George W. Bush was selected as president here?
Not really. Certainly not, no. I think top-placed officials, I think if memory serves, the prime minister in France and Germany have come out since it was clearly going to be George W. Bush in the White House and reiterated their long-standing opposition to national missile defense. Britain's in a rather more ambiguous position. I think the Brits would, as usual, like to play honest broker between the Europeans and the Americans, and rumor has it that there are some in the inner circles in Tony Blair's cabinet that are not entirely opposed to the idea of national missile defense, possibly because they feel they could possibly creep in under the edge of it. But that's simply rumor. Certainly, officially, they are very dubious about it. So far, they've been sort of trying to communicate between the two camps. But there doesn't seem to be a lot of communication on this. The Europeans have said repeatedly that they don't like this.
I wanted to wrap up the discussion with Bruce Gagnon, who's coordinator for Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. What are you doing at the grassroots level around the issue of weapons in space?
Well, since 1992, we've been building an international constituency to educate and mobilize people around the world to keep space for peace, to make sure that this new arms race doesn't move into the heavens. Particularly, what we do is I spend about 2 to 3 weeks out of the month traveling around the United States and around the world, first to key communities where the Space Command has installations and where the aerospace corporations are working on Star Wars technology, to teach people about all the things we've learned from reading the Space Command documents, Vision for 2020, and other things like that. And now we're going out beyond that just to other communities and really building this whole infrastructure. And then in coming months, we have a whole series of protests starting February 3rd. There's going to be a protest in Munich when Rumsfeld goes there to try to convince the European allies to come on board Star Wars. And then February 10th through 12th, we're going to be in Albuquerque, New Mexico, protesting at a major space nuclear power and propulsion conference because they're talking about using nuclear power in order to generate the massive power projection capabilities for these space-based laser weapons that they'd like to begin flight testing by the year 2012. And then in March, we're having an international space organizing conference and protest in Huntsville, Alabama. Huntsville at the Army Redstone Arsenal is one of the places where missile defense is being directed. And then in May, we're having an international conference in Leeds, England, a place where the United States has one of the radar facilities, actually two of them in that area, that need to be upgraded for Star Wars. And so the British government has to give their permission.
That does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Terry Allen and Chris Abrams, our engineer Anthony Sloan, Errol Maitland, our technical director. From the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Band and The Fired, from the studios of our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
I'm John Wiener, contributing.